Welcome, everyone, to the College Sports Briefing, your in-depth look at the business, legal, and social issues impacting college athletics today. I'm Daniel Hare, and on today's podcast, we're going to talk about the decision by Regional National Labor Relations Board Director Peter Sung Orr to grant Northwestern scholarship football players employee status and the right to form a union. We're going to walk through this decision step by step, as well as discuss the next likely steps and address practical questions that the decision raises. We have a lot to get to today. It's Sunday, April 6th, and I'm glad you're here. Let's get right into it. Now, as a brief sort of preamble or prelude to the topic of the union decision, I think we need to talk a little bit about judicial review and the court's role in deciding law. And we'll get to kind of the next steps in this case here in a little bit. But as most experts, and if you're listening to this, you've probably read some of the material out there on this decision, and almost everyone says it's likely to end up in the federal court system at some point, and that's likely true. And I think one of the things that we just as a society, and not just in relation to this case, but just in terms of how we view courts generally, especially review courts such as courts of appeal and the Supreme Court, we need to take a look at kind of our expectations for what those justices, those appeal panels are supposed to do. Because every time I hear commentary about how a judge or a court is viewing an issue or should view an issue, a lot of that tends to come from a place of what the law ought to be or what the law should be. And if appellate courts are applying the law properly, and in my view, and I think the way that the framers set up appeals courts, it's that the judges are to say what the law is. They're basically there to explain gray areas or discrepancies or places that were left unanswered by the actual text of the statute or the Constitution, or simply how it might be interpreted. And obviously, when you have between conservative and liberal types of justices, they have different outlooks on what the law means. But inevitably, they're all looking, or should be looking, at the same for the same ultimate goal, which is what did the original drafters of the law intend? What was the intent? What is the law as it stands now? It is not what the law ought to be or what the law should be. And so when I hear people talk about, well, we shouldn't allow student athletes to be employees, or we shouldn't allow other types of things like that, well, that's all great. That's for the legislature. That's for us as citizens to enable and encourage our legislature to pass laws to address those issues. It is not the court's role. And so when we say things like that, what we're, I think, really saying is, okay, if the court decides that the decision was wrong and we feel otherwise, then we need to pass a new statute or amend the Constitution to make it plain and clear what it is we feel the law ought to be. And, you know, if they got it right, then they get it right. Great. And so, I think we have to really be careful about what we're asking judges to do. We're not asking them to write new law. We're asking them to tell us what the law means and how it applies in a certain set of facts. And if we haven't maybe contemplated certain facts, such as we've never really thought about, could student athletes be employees or are they employees? Should they be employees? All of those types of issues. And the laws as they were drafted at the time that they were drafted didn't comprehend or contemplate those questions. You know, it's very likely that they weren't addressed, and we need a court to step in and say, okay, how does the law as drafted apply in this set of circumstances? And even if that results in something that maybe isn't intuitive or isn't logical, it's not the court's role to make it logical. It's the court's role to apply the law as it's written to the facts in front of us. And if that sort of leads to a strange result or even an unjust result, that's okay, that's the way it was supposed to be. And then it's up to us as citizens and as through our legislators and our president or governor or in whatever, you know, frame we're talking about to pass new laws and correct issues within the law that maybe weren't contemplated when they were written. And so I think we have to be really, really careful about kind of how we view these things when they go over the courts, you know, and this is generally, this isn't just limited to the way we look at issues related to student athletes and as employees or student athletes in terms of antitrust laws, which we talk a lot about here. But this is just in general in the way we should view, I think, all of our legal world and all of the different cases that are going up through appellate courts and through the Supreme Court, and that there's a system in place and it works. And we just need to, you know, make sure that we're not putting unrealistic and never really intended expectations on judges or sets of judges. And so I thought that was an important thing to kind of get out there first before we got into the actual decision itself. But let's now go into the decision by the union. By now, of course, when we record every couple of weeks, oftentimes there will be news breaking, you know, a couple of days after we record, and then it takes a while before we're able to get something up on it. And I've written a piece on businessofcollegesports.com, which goes through my initial reactions to the decision. And I encourage you to go over and read that. But I did think, even though it's been 10 days or so, 11 days since the decision was announced, I did think it was still a very valuable use of time to go through the decision and kind of look at what was emphasized, what wasn't emphasized, and what we can learn from it going forward. And so I thought, let's just first go through the sort of the decision step by step. I'm not going to obviously go through all of it. I am going to quote a few things out of it because I think it's instructive. And let's start with sort of the facts and the testimony that were given that the director, the regional director of the National Labor Relations Board thought what was important. One of the things was the special rules or the extra rules that student athletes are forced to abide by, not just in terms of NCAA rules, but also institutional rules in terms and the control that universities have over them and coaches have over them. And I thought one paragraph here, and I'll quote from it here. It says, quote, employers, players, both scholarship players and walk-ons, are subject to certain team and athletic department rules set forth inter alia in the team handbook that is applicable solely to the employers, players, and Northwestern's athletic department handbook. Northwestern's regular student population is not subject to these rules and policies. Specifically, freshman and sophomore year players receiving scholarships are required to live in on-campus dormitories. Only upperclassmen players are permitted to live off campus, and even they are required to submit their lease to Coach Fitzgerald for his approval before they can enter into it. If players want to obtain outside employment, they must likewise first obtain permission from the athletic department. So that was kind of, this is early on in the decision. This is, again, a 24-page decision. This is in page 4. And so you can already kind of get a sense of where this is going, where the director thought there were things that were important. Here's another one, quote, similarly, players are required to disclose to their coaches detailed information pertaining to the vehicle that they drive. The players must also abide by a social media policy, which restricts what they can post on the internet, including Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. In fact, the players are prohibited from denying a coach's friend request, and the former's postings are monitored. The employer prohibits players from giving media interviews unless they are directed to participate in interviews that are arranged by the athletic department. Players are prohibited from swearing in public, and if a player embarrasses the team, he can be suspended for one game. A second offense of this nature can result in a suspension of up to 1 year. And then skip down one more paragraph. During the regular season, the players are required to wear a suit to home games and team-issued travel sweats when traveling to an away football game. They're also required to remain within a 6-hour radius of campus prior to football games. Now, I believe that these are not extra special rules necessarily related to Northwestern. I think most teams, especially at the Division I level in football, men's basketball, as well as many of the other sports and at different levels, but will all have a very similar rules to this. But, you know, I think it, when you're looking at it in the context of the amount of control that a coach, a school, and a university and administration has over a student athlete, you know, when, and you start to actually lay all these things out, it really does start to take a toll. And I think that's what happened on the director here in this case, as he was contemplating his decision, that there are all of these rules that they're subject to, and you know, that not every student at the university, even if they're on some type of other scholarship in maybe a different discipline, art or music, that they're not regulated in the way that these student athletes are. The next set of interesting points that the decision goes through are on time commitment. And I'm not going to go through all this. You can imagine the time commitment, but basically there's, you know, four pages here. I'm just looking through it right now. Four pages that are just sort of detailing from the beginning of a training camp in the fall all the way through to the next, you know, basically for a calendar year, what are the time requirements of a football student athlete at Northwestern. And again, I don't think they are atypical. I think that if you look at other schools, you would see similar calendars and itineraries. But it's just when you lay them out from the beginning to the end, the amount of hours that these student athletes are putting in for football, and then you weigh them against how much time are they sort of allowed to spend on academics, it really becomes an issue, especially when you're trying to claim that they're really students first. And that's really, I think, where the director was going here. Okay, and then the next issue that the director discusses, and I wanted to point this out because it isn't something that really takes a big stage here, is the revenue situation. And a lot's made, obviously, in the public discussion about this issue of the amount of revenue that the university will bring in because of major college football. And what I thought was interesting is that as I read through this again, a 24-page decision, there is really one paragraph in the state of the facts, and I'm on page 13 now before we get to it. I'll go ahead and read it to you because I don't want to act like I'm totally dismissing it. So let's go ahead and read it first and I'll comment on it. Quote, "The employer's football team generates revenue in various ways, including ticket sales, television broadcast contracts with various networks, and the sale of football team merchandise. The employer reported to the Department of Education that its football team generated total revenues of $235 million and incurred total expenses of $159 million between 2003 and 2012. For the 2012-13 academic year, the employer reported that its football program generated $30.1 million in revenue and $21.7 million in expenses. However, the latter figure does not include costs to maintain the stadium, which total between $250,000 and $500,000 per calendar year. In addition, the profit realized from the football team's annual revenue is utilized to subsidize the employer's non-revenue generating sports. For instance, all other varsity sports with the exception of men's basketball. This in turn assists the employer in ensuring that it offers a proportionate number of men's and women's varsity sports in compliance with Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972. So that is one paragraph. It's about 10 lines long in a 24-page decision. There is hardly anything else in here. There's one part later where it discusses that issue. And what I, again, continue to think about with this is how important it was to the director that the time commitment, the control of the coaches over the student athletes played in this decision, as opposed to simply the revenue generated by the football program. Okay, so let's move on here in the decision. We've talked through the sort of the facts, and now we get into the actual analysis. And so the director talks about, and this is what was always sort of the reason why I thought this decision could go this way, even though I was surprised by the result. But the fact that within the National Labor Relations Act, it simply defines employee as employee. It basically doesn't define it at all. And so as that means the director here is he's looking at what's the definition of employee is basically going to case law in the Supreme Court, looking at how they define employee, which is very, very broad. And basically they say it's a person who performs services for another under a contract of hire subject to the other's control or right of control and in return for payment. And that definition is the kind of framework and the foundation for calling student athletes in this situation employees. And as we kind of go through this, he says, quote, while it is true that the players do not receive a paycheck in the traditional sense, they nevertheless receive a substantial economic benefit for playing football. The fact that the employer, and then it talks about the fact that the employer does not treat scholarships or stipends as taxable income is not dispositive of whether or not it is compensation. Basically, that there is compensation in the form of a scholarship. So there are services being provided in exchange for compensation, and therefore it fits the definition of an employee. It says it is clear, quote, it is clear that the scholarships the players receive are in exchange for the athletics services being performed. And then it says, quote, the head coach of the football team in consultation with the athletic department can immediately reduce or cancel the player's scholarship for a variety of reasons. Indeed, the scholarship is clearly tied to the player's performance of athletic services, as evidenced by the fact that scholarships can be immediately canceled if the player voluntarily withdraws from the team or abuses team rules. So it is under the control of the employer here, the university, the coach, and it is a service in exchange for compensation. If the player stops participating or withdraws from the team, the compensation stops. It's an exchange of service. It's not a package of financial aid that requires or that doesn't require any action on top of the just being an attendant in attendance at the university. And so I thought that was a really, really important point here. And then we look at, okay, you know, are the football players under the control of the university or the employer? And as we look at that, it says, quote, the record establishes that the player who receives scholarships are under strict and exacting control by their employer throughout their entire year. Commencing with training camp, which begins approximately 6 weeks before the start of the academic year, the coaches exercise a great deal of control over the players. This is evidenced by the fact that the coaches prepare and provide daily itineraries to the players, which set forth hour by hour what football-related activities the players are to engage in from as early as 5:45 a.m. until 10:30 p.m. when they are expected to be in bed. Not surprisingly, the players spend 50 to 60 hours per week engaging in football-related activities during training camp. In addition, the location, duration, and manner in which the players carry out their football duties are all within the control of the football coaches. And we skip down again. The coaches have control, quote, the coaches have control over nearly every aspect of the players' private lives by the virtue of the fact that there are many rules that they must follow under the threat of discipline and or the loss of a scholarship. The players have restrictions placed on them and or have to obtain permission from the coaches before they can make living arrangements, apply for outside employment, drive personal vehicles, travel off campus, post items on the internet, speak to the media, use alcohol and drugs, and engage in gambling. The fact that some of these rules are put in place to protect players and the employer from running afoul of NCAA rules does not detract from the amount of control the coaches exert over the players' daily lives. And so again, really looking hard in this analysis at what is the level of control and what is the time commitment that the student athletes have. And basically then it goes into, okay, all of that being said, and he says, quote, in sum, based on the entire record of this case, I find the employer's football players who receive scholarships fall squarely within the Act's broad definition of employee when one considers the common law definition of employee. And I think the no gray area, no, this is a close call, no, we should give this, you know, more consideration. I mean, this was an authoritative decision that, hey, this isn't even a close call, that the way that the laws are currently written, the way that the rules are currently set up, they are employees and it's not even close. And so I thought that was probably the most interesting part of the decision was the level of conviction that Director Orr had as he makes this decision. And then one other point that I thought was really appropriate, since I spent a lot of time in a post a few weeks ago on College Sports Briefs about sort of the similarities between this case and the Brown case, Brown University, and the graduate assistants or the graduate research or graduate teaching assistants at Brown University, and how those types of cases have made their way through the National Labor Relations Board before. And the most recent case, the Brown case, favored the side of the universities there and did not classify graduate assistants as employees. The director here does not say that Brown ought to be overturned or that in some way this is, not good rulings anymore, but because at first what he says is Brown is not applicable. The reason that they said that is that, and I'll read this just right out of the decision here, quote, the board found that in Brown, he's talking about, the board found that graduate assistants were not employees after considering four factors. One, the status of graduate assistants as students. Two, the role of the graduate student assistantships in graduate education. Three, the graduate student assistants' relationship with the faculty. And four, the financial support they received to attend Brown University. In applying these factors, the board concluded that the overall relationship between the graduate assistants and their university was primarily an educational one rather than an economic one. Although I find that this statutory test is inapplicable in the instant case because the players' football-related duties are unrelated to their academic studies, unlike the graduate assistants whose teaching and research duties were inextricably related to their graduate degree requirements, for the reasons discussed below, the outcome would not change even after applying the four factors of the facts of this case. And I thought that was really interesting that, okay, he's not going to apply Brown here and look at these facts in light of Brown, but he's saying even if he did, they'd still be employees because, and here's why. And I'll just briefly do this, that the players are not primarily students. The players in this case are at best 50-50, and more likely they're more athletes than students. And that was not the case in Brown, where they're there almost primarily and exclusively for their education. And in fact, what they're doing and related to their assistantship position is so related. It goes down further. The football players' athletic duties do not constitute a core element of their educational degree requirements. Some of these Brown graduate assistants had to do part of this work that they did to get their degree. It was part of their degree requirements. Not the case, obviously, within college athletics. Faculty does not supervise scholarship players, so you have no faculty involvement. And then lastly, compensation is not financial aid. And so, whereas in the Brown case, you had some graduate students who were receiving financial aid, and they were also graduate teaching assistants, but they were not, it was, the aid was not contingent upon them doing the research or doing the teaching assistant. It was simply financial aid package to allow them to go to school. It was not a service in exchange for compensation. And within the athletics world, that is not the case at all. If you withdraw from the team, if you do not participate in the team, you have lost your scholarship or it will be pulled. And so it's not financial aid in the same sense that it was in the Brown case. So again, he didn't apply Brown here. He didn't say that Brown should be overturned or that Brown wasn't good. He just simply said, look, even if we did apply Brown, this is a no-brainer situation. The student athletes are employees. So that's the decision as I've gone through it. What are the next steps? Well, we know that Northwestern is going to appeal the decision. They're going to do that. They've already announced that they will do it. They have a deadline to formally do so by April 9th. And then we also have a vote scheduled. So just because the National Labor Relations Board has said that they are employees and have the right to unionize, they still have to hold a vote. And so there are 76 eligible scholarship football players at Northwestern who can vote to unionize or not to unionize. And then once that happens, and I should say the vote potentially could be delayed if the National Labor Relations Board decides to go ahead and hear the appeal prior to April 25th. I think most don't seem to think that's likely, that it will be after April 25th before there's any decision made on whether to hear the appeal. And so you likely will see a vote, and presumably there are enough votes within that 76 to have a union. And at that point, what you're going to have is most likely Northwestern refusing to acknowledge that union, and definitely, I would assume, not begin negotiating with that union until it's all resolved at the national level and then ultimately over in the court system. So a few questions that have been raised sort of in light of this decision, and let's talk a little bit about those real quick. Would just revenue sports have unions, or would all participating sports be in the same union? Those are a couple questions. So, you know, if you read that decision, and we've just gone through it, does it really seem like it is applicable only to football or only to revenue producing sports? Those issues of player control, those issues of a scholarship in being contingent upon athletic service, those issues related to time commitment, I don't see any of those factors being limited to football or men's basketball. Again, there was one paragraph about revenue generation. The rest of it was all about all of those other factors. And so I definitely think this is not limited to revenue sports. As of now, it's simply limited to Northwestern scholarship football players. But I do think going forward, you could see other sports, non-revenue included, pursue this path. And would all participating sports be in the same union? I don't think necessarily. And so, I mean, certainly could. I think that's still an open question and one that we don't know how will play out. There are a lot of questions that we simply don't know practically how they will play out. Private and public athletes, how will those kind of go together? Obviously, the as you've probably read or heard, the National Labor Relations Board only governs private institutions. They do not govern public institutions. Those are all state law based. And so any student athlete at a public institution will have to go and navigate their own state laws regarding unions. And some states it's very challenging to form a union as a public employee. And so, and certainly there's variance between states on that. So it'll be interesting to see how that comes about. The impact of Title IX. I think where we are with Title IX in this comes down to, are we now under a situation where if they are employees, do they continue to be under Title IX in terms of, is it an educational program? Because that's what Title IX applies to, educational opportunities. If these are no longer educational opportunities, I think there's a case to be made that Title IX no longer applies to the way you treat any unionized employee group. And so I think there's a case to be made there. The folks over at the Title IX blog are making the case that you now fall under both National Labor Relations Board law and rules, as well as Title IX. And so you have to somehow achieve all things that are regulated here, and that's going to be a real challenge. I think there's a case to be made. You also have case law which allows for instance, men's basketball head coaches to earn more money than women's basketball head coaches, simply based on factors such as market demand the amount of revenue that they drive is so much greater. And so you get into the employee world, I think there's more of a case to be made there that there's not an equal amount of compensation that's necessarily required. And then lastly, what are tax implications? Right now, you know, these student athletes are receiving scholarships worth tens of thousands of dollars and paying no tax on them. And will there, you know, if they are, if those are considered to be wages or, you know, compensation in lieu of wages that are for employees, would they be taxed? And I think the answer currently would be yes. And we'd have to probably get some sort of fix on that, above and beyond a scholarship to, in terms of stipend, which would be enough to sort of cover a tax burden, or have an actual fix in the tax code to exempt these types of wages or compensation from being taxable wages. So there's a lot to take into account, obviously, here, and there's a lot still left to learn and know, and it is going to take a long, long time probably to resolve all of this. I don't anticipate there being any type of negotiation between a university and a union on behalf of student athletes anytime soon, but there's no question that this has really pushed everything forward in terms of what the NCAA is facing with regard to amateurism and the future of the current model. We've got the O'Bannon case set for trial June 9th, and we've got other cases coming up, obviously, that we've talked about before. So there's just a lot here that over time, over the next few months and years, you know, I think we're going to see a different model come out of this. And so that's where we are. And that's all the time we have on this episode. And I know we covered a lot. Thanks for bearing in there. I encourage you to go to the blog, collegesportsbriefs.com, for show notes and links to the things we talked about, as well as other articles on college sports law and business. The podcast is now in all major directories, including iTunes, and I would love for you to go find the show, leave a review, and subscribe. You can also go to collegesportsbriefs.com/iTunes to get directly to the show on iTunes. And finally, you can check out the Facebook page, facebook.com/collegesportsbriefs, and you can follow me on Twitter at Daniel Hare. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this edition of the College Sports Briefing.